Adventure tourism writer Chris Parry joins us today to explore the growing phenomena of battlefield tourism, and he's also going to share his latest trek with us into the jungles of Borneo, retracing one of World War II's most infamous death marches. Christopher, hello.
Hello, Chrissy, how are you?
I'm not bad. Battlefield tourism. I find it a bit tricky to put those two words into the same title. It kind of seems wrong in some ways, doesn't it? You kind of think of tourism as pleasure-seeking, but this type of tourism, it's so very different.
I think it's so very different because of the way it is defined. I mean, if we take the first three words when you form a definition, so for battlefield tourism, it's an interest in. What comes next? What comes after that? Well, with battlefield tourism, it's the motivation. So it's as much about the motivation as it is the actual destination. So what's so important with battlefield tourism is why someone is going there. So there can be that strong spiritual element because of the sacrifice that we know people made. And that's what, I guess, makes it a pilgrimage. And you talked about how people were originally described as pilgrims going to battlefield sites. But particularly if you visit now and you've got a connection to the site because of family or someone in your community that you knew, it takes on that rite of passage to it, that pilgrimage, if you like. And then there's also wanting a tangible physical challenge and reconciliation with what we've read about or seen in the movies. So you've watched Gallipoli, you've seen them charge at the end at the Battle of the Neck, and you go to Gallipoli and you see that the neck is actually no bigger than two tennis courts. So there's that reconciliation in your mind with something you're familiar with, the size of tennis courts, and that these guys weren't fighting on huge, broad fields, you know, hundreds of miles in distance, that they're actually very small and very confined spaces. So that brings it all home to you when you can actually visit these sites and you can smell the humidity of jungle, you can look up at cliffs. That's what the reality of visiting these sites is all about.
Chris, they define pilgrims as people visiting a sacred site. How do you think these sites are sacred to Aussies?
I think they're certainly sacred because even the fact that you play that John Williamson song, certainly for Australians, there's almost a cultural expectation these days. But we are great travellers, and travel for us is, I think, starts out as a real honour and a privilege because we're so far away from anywhere. We're not used to travelling. So when we do travel for the first time, it is with a heart that is, I think, looking for where we have been before. The opportunity to visit a site where our own countrymen have lost their life. And particularly, you know, there's been a lot of talk on your program today about Father's Day. And so as a man, to actually be able to visit these sites, or as a mother even as well, where sons have died, it's a blood connection. Even if you're not directly related to them, they're your own countrymen that went overseas as well for what they thought was their first big adventure. And they expected to come back, and they didn't. And I think to stand on the spots where they died and recognise the sacrifice that they made is what does make it take on that very sacred connection.
Yeah. Now, you've never been in the armed forces, have you?
No, not at all. I guess my connection my interest almost beyond battlefield tourism, but certainly the prisoner of war experience of Australians, came from growing up in a small country town where the mayor of the town, when I was a boy, who was a friend of my father's, and he'd been a survivor on the Thai-Burma Railway. And he was a pretty tall man, but I believe he was a lot taller before the war. He was very stooped when he came back. But hearing his story from when I was a young boy certainly taught me a lot about the experiences of those guys at a time when probably we weren't learning a lot about prisoners of war. We were still sort of focused when I was growing up on the heroic image, I guess, of Gallipoli and the Western Front and Kokoda as well. Prisoners of war weren't receiving the same attention that they duly deserve today.
How much interest have you found in the battlefield tourism genre?
I think a lot, and certainly what is happening at the moment, certainly through Southeast Asia, particularly in Malaysia, is the interest in the stories where Australians were prisoners of war. So, and this is actually taking that genre of battlefield tourism to a different level. Because if you look at Gallipoli, the Western Front, Kokoda, Tobruk, they were all battlefields where our guys had guns and could fight back. But Sandak and Turinau, the death marches, or the prisoner of war camp on Ambon, or the prisoner of war camp at Changi, or at Thai Burma Railway, they were guys who couldn't fight back. They were guys that were imprisoned and deserved to survive the war, and most of them didn't.
Yeah. So, what do you feel when you are at one of these places? How do you encapsulate it for people?
Well, I think I was just thinking about the most recent trek I did up there. I've done the Sandak and Turinau trek a couple of times now. And one of the other things that's changed with battlefield tourism is I think this is happening with Kokoda as well. There are people doing it for the physical challenge, not so much the historical challenge of learning what's happened. People want to test themselves in these environments. And I know that on my most recent trek, there were two particular blokes, both in the mining industry, and very fit. They'd prepared themselves for the trek. They'd Googled difficult treks you can do. And they'd found this one, Sandak and Turinau. Didn't really know much about the history. Knew something about, you know, prisoners of war having walked through the jungle. But they were there for the physical challenge of it. Now, when one of these blokes was asked to step forward to read as part of a service we do at Kundasang War Memorial, he burst into tears. And we just sat there. Well, we were standing there and we watched him. And he stopped. We let him compose himself. And then he said, "You know why I burst out into tears? Because I'm thinking of Richard Murray, one of the prisoners of war who was the best mate of Keith Bottrell, one of those six survivors. And they'd stolen rice, a bunch of them. And Richard Murray knew that someone had to own up to it, otherwise they were all going to be killed. The Japanese found the rice. And he stepped forward knowing he would be killed. Now, when this guy on the trek, who was only there for the physical challenge of it, stepped forward, all of a sudden it became a lot more to him, that trek. He took on all of the history that we'd taught him and thought of Richard Murray in that moment.
Wow. Yeah, it's very moving stuff, isn't it? So you get a lot more.
You do, yeah.
Tell us about this. Actually, you know what, we're going to go to a quick break. Chris, can you stay with us and we'll talk about this Sandak and trek. Would that be okay?
Sure.
Cool. It's 20 minutes past two. You're listening to 882 6PR.
On 882 6PR, The Weekender with Chrissy Morrissey.
22 minutes past two. Thanks for your company today. And we are talking an interesting type of tourism. It's called battlefield tourism. And many of you, you know, when you go on a holiday, you think of yourself as relaxing, you know, leisure. But there is this new, it's not new actually, it's been around since after Gallipoli. People used to go to the site there. And we're having a chat right now with Chris Parry, adventure tourism writer. We've been talking about battlefield tourism. And in particular, Chris is about to share with us his most recent trek or journey that he's been on, which was in Borneo. Chris, hi. Thanks again for being on the program.
That's okay.
So tell us about the tour. What was your interest in doing this particular tour?
I guess it's a continued interest in the prisoner of war story, certainly of Australians, but in particular, this is a story with such a massive loss of life, and for so long was a little known story as well, and it deserves to be promoted as much as we can, you know, from 2,434 prisoners of war, of which close to 1,800 of them were Australians, and then to only have six survivors, and all of those six survivors were Australians, is just horrific, and we can't learn any more than the information we have. You know, there's nothing more we can dig up. There's no one left to talk to about it. The information that we have is all that we have, and must be passed on at every opportunity.
So the trek itself is from Sandakan to Renard. Tell us about those two places and why the POWs were made to do the walk.
The POWs were made to do the walk because of the Japanese fear of invasion. So it was sort of 1945. They'd been moved there from Singapore in 1942 to build an airstrip as part of plans for Japanese expansion. The airstrip never really became operational. And then with the threat of invasion, there were increasing bombing raids from particularly the Americans. So the Japanese thought, we still want to keep this workforce, so we'll march them across. They were hopefully going to get them to Jesselton, which we now call Kota Kinabalu. But basically, there were three different death marches, and the third one, really, that they didn't even make Renau. There were 75 prisoners of war, and really, that they were the last of the sick guys in the camp at Sandakan, and not one of them made it more than a few miles. And then the rest of them that made it to Renau. In your introduction, you talked about the ones that were killed after the war. So there were 10 officers and 5 enlisted men, and they were shot 12 days after the war had been finished. So, and the Japanese weren't to know that 6 had survived, basically by slipping off the track and hiding and making their way to safety. But the Japanese thought they'd covered up all traces of what they had done, thought they'd eliminated them all, and they got the shock of their lives when 6 of them rocked up to the war trials at the end of the war. The Japanese wondered why they'd been called to account. They didn't think there was anyone left to tell the tale. And 6 survivors got up there and were able to tell us what happened.
So tell us about the actual trek itself, because the Japanese enlisted locals, didn't they, to make the trek?
Yeah, and that was heartbreaking for the locals, because the locals didn't, they weren't aware that the trek was going to be used by the prisoners of war. So they made the trek as difficult as possible, because life under the Japanese for them had been very difficult as well. So they wanted to keep the track away from the villages, so that they didn't want the Japanese using their food and resources. So a lot of the villages were also close to the water sources, so that they kept the track away from the water sources, and they put it up the most steepest mountains you could imagine. Big, just like I think the description has come from Papua New Guinea sometimes with Kokoda, these razorback ridges. And that's just the same in Borneo as well. So this track went up sheer cliffs and down the other side through foliage that the prisoners of war described as a green cage, a jungle so dense that it was dark, that light couldn't filter through from the canopy down to the track that they were walking on. And that's exactly what you experience when you're walking through this jungle, that the humidity is just so dense, and it's not a light, green, you know, airy feeling when you're walking through it. It's a very thick, damp feeling, and through large parts of it, it's very dark.
Did you, on the tour yourself, did you have much interaction with the locals?
Yeah, lots. Look, the villages are one of the things which I think make the trek most valuable. Speaking with the children and speaking with the families, and they've all got connections to the story. On the last trek I did, we met an old fella who actually used a blowpipe to kill a few Japanese soldiers, and he's one of the few left that actually is old enough to remember those times. But they're very good at holding on to the stories and passing on the stories, and the hospitality is wonderful as well.
So what did you get out of it, Christopher Parry?
I think what I get out of it, I continue to maintain a lot of knowledge, which I can hopefully pass on to people, and through programs like this. You know, there might be people listening that have never heard this story before, and after this interview, they can go and Google it and learn more and find books to read, maybe come up to Borneo and do the trek themselves. So that's an important thing that I get out of it. I think what I also continue to get out of it is that amazing sense of loss. I think of people like Richard Murray, and it was a Christ-like sacrifice, you know, to step forward knowing that you're going to be killed. And I think to take out of it something beyond the statistics, and the statistics are horrific. Over 99% of those prisoners were killed. I seek to take out of it the personal side of it, the stories of these men and the emotions that they must have had in trying to survive and seeing their mates die.
Well, tell me, genuinely, at the end of that holiday, because most people go on a holiday to relax and unwind, did you feel like you needed a break at the end of it, or were you able to come back to work and just get straight back into it? How did you feel?
I was fortunate this time around that I was already preparing for another trek, if you like. I was actually going to be climbing Mount Agung in Bali, and also, not to be flippant about it, but I had another adventure that was scaring the wits out of me, which was a trip to Legoland with my kids, which I was probably more scared about than trekking the jungles of Borneo. But that turned out to be a wonderful experience.
Oh, that's a nice segue into Father's Day tomorrow, isn't it?
Well, look, it is.
Chris, thanks so much for coming on the program today.
That's okay. It's been a wonderful opportunity to talk about a story which I hope some of your listeners now know a little bit more about.